Hello and welcome to APAC Weekly, where we bring you a showcase of our conversations on the APAC network. Coming up this week, the future of mining in the green revolution, the psychology of climate change denial, and Indonesia building the world's largest industrial park powered by renewables. The World Bank has predicted the global demand for materials required for low carbon technologies will increase rapidly. Lithium, for example, as much as 1,000% by 2050. If we can't find those reserves, though, we'll need increased production to extract them. To talk more about this, we're joined now by John Mavrogiannis, Professor of Economic Geology at the Australian National University. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today. Now, demand, of course, is increasing massively for critical minerals, but we still need to mine traditional metals and minerals as well. Tell us about the role the mining sector is going to play in the technology and the green revolutions.
Yes, well, as you know, Australia is a major provider of many conventional materials like copper and one of the biggest exporters of iron ore and coal on Earth. We also produce a lot of gold. So we're a very capable mining nation, and we're going to have to set our sights on some other things to mine, like, for instance, rare earths, and you mentioned lithium. And one of the advantages there is that as we get out of the coal business, we can mine lithium and rare earths instead, so that it's not a net loss of jobs. We could just continue mining, just mine different things. So I think it's going to play a big role globally.
You've said before, Professor, that there are tough decisions that need to be made when it comes to mining, of course. You know, we need to decide how valuable a place is. Is there not a way in this age where we're innovating so quickly that we can de-risk the mining process to a much greater extent than we are at the moment?
Yes, I think we can. I mean, you know, we've been to the moon, so we can do almost anything if we set our minds to it. However, you know, there are inherent risks in mining, especially if you're mining in an area with significant rainfall and groundwater. If there's a lot of water around and you're trying to keep that water clean, it's not always technically possible to keep it clean. So one of the advantages we have is that we're a huge continent and much of the continent is desert. So that if we dig a big hole in the ground in the middle of the Yilgarn, and there's very little rainfall, there's very little risk to anything there. There are risks involved with smelting and downstream, but for the most part, we're pretty safe here in that there aren't that many places that we would put at risk. But to answer your question specifically, yes, of course we can mine safely and cleanly, but that takes a lot of oversight. In other words, it's not always simple, especially when there's a lot of water around.
When it comes to mining those type of minerals, the critical minerals, safely, the way that we need to do it so that we can mine in places that might have significant rainfall, as you've just been talking about, what sort of regulations are needed that we don't yet have?
Well, you know, we do have a pretty good system of regulation. I think we just have to be careful to abide by it. One of the advantages of the bigger companies is they have shareholders that will hold them to be responsible. With the smaller juniors and some of the companies that don't have a big global footprint, they can take more chances. But I think it takes strong government and good leadership to say that we must do this cleanly or not do it at all. So we've talked about, like in the Tarkine Forest, do we really want to mine tungsten there? And probably the answer is that the native forest might be worth more than the tungsten, and so we should probably leave it. But much of Australia, it's not a problem. Now, lithium is an interesting one because mining what we call pegmatites, the granitic pegmatites, where the lithium is held, is a pretty clean situation in that there aren't a lot of sulfide minerals to make sulfuric acid. So it's not generally a chemically dangerous business. In other words, there aren't a lot of threats. So I think that we could certainly in the Northern Territory and in WA, we could probably mine a lot of the pegmatites cleanly without changing regulations terribly much.
So when it comes to technology and the role technology plays, you know, you mentioned certain areas where it may be better not to mine in those particular areas. But if we come to the point where demand increases to the level where we need those minerals and we're not sourcing them elsewhere, perhaps from other countries or other areas, what sort of technology should we expect to see which will allow this to happen? I mean, how close are we to that point?
Well, you know, it's fascinating that I was just reading about a lithium mine in Spain, and they couldn't get permits to make an open pit there. So what they did was they drove underground shafts in, and then they process all the ore within a building that's using green hydrogen for power, so that it doesn't look terribly bad. There's no mass, it's all contained, and there's really no greenhouse gases produced, so that if we want to get technological and, you know, use electricity that's from solar and other forms, we could technically mine incredibly cleanly.
Have you seen any really exciting technology lately, you know, new technology, new innovation, you know, within the mining sector when it comes to, you know, bringing us closer to that net zero level that's going to help us in the future? Is there anything that you've seen recently that's really exciting to you?
Yeah, there are many places that are starting to use electricity, so they can, rather than use the big diesel powers, many of them are putting solar power in. So slowly but surely, I think we're starting to get there. We can start to use, you know, we can use computer-driven tractors. We can mine underground without people having to be there. We can pretty much just use electricity very soon. We're not there yet. We still are very reliant on diesel, but that's a switch that we're just going to have to make, and the ability is there.
As the drive towards net zero continues to gather pace, more and more focus is being put on urban mobility and transportation systems. Innovation around new purpose-built vehicle concepts, new ways of powering vehicles, and the sharing economy are all racing ahead. Dr. Donna Ferretti joins us now for more on this. Now, Doctor, this reshaping of the landscape did start some time ago. It accelerated, of course, due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Do you see this pace of change continuing?
I'm probably pessimistically, yes, I do. Although I think there are signs, certainly within local communities, of a resistance to some of the sort of like technology-led solutions to what's happened to our cities since COVID. But really, it's a trend that's been going on for a very long time. I think COVID's just allowed an acceleration of some of this as a way of reinvigorating economies. You build lots of infrastructure. And in Australia, in the Australian cities, and certainly in New Zealand cities as well, I've just returned from New Zealand, as it turns out, satellite road infrastructure is seen as a really quick kind of like infrastructure build to stimulate the economy and employ lots of blokes on road gangs. But I think that's a very partial solution, and one that I believe is actually flawed in terms of the future of our cities and our capacity to withstand the pressures of the coming world.
So what's the drive here? I mean, climate change, obviously, getting rid of the fuel-guzzling cars that are on our roads. I mean, is that the push behind it, and is that what we're being too slow to change?
Well, I think that's the push, absolutely, and the sort of like the heralding of the electric car as some sort of like panacea to all of our transportation emissions issues is actually fundamentally flawed, especially in Australia. You know, most electric vehicles will be powered by non-renewable energy forms, as it turns out, until we actually transform our grid, which is a very ageing grid, and we're seeing the results of that at the moment in terms of the problems with power supply to the eastern seaboard. We need to get serious about climate change and get serious about the notion of transport emissions in our cities being one of the chief contributors to global warming. And we need to actually realise this. We need to take advantage of Australia's more generally huge advantages in terms of renewable energy resources and start using these to transform our cities. I'm glad that you used the term mobility in your introduction, because transport and mobility have two very, very different meanings. Mm. And what I'm disappointed with in our policy responses is that the response is to transport, getting from A to B as quickly as possible. Mobility patterns are changing dramatically. There are signs of young people in particular are no longer wanting to drive as much as previous generations have, basically just almost naturally jumped into a car and expect that's the way you get around in the urban area. And there is a desire now, I think, for a more broader scope of transport modes to be used in our cities more productively, and for governments to take those alternative transport modes seriously rather than just pumping all of their efforts into creating more roads, road infrastructure, and basically being a slave to the fossil fuel industry at the moment.
So what is the panacea, Doctor? How do you see this playing out? You know, if you could have everything that you wanted and you could have the mobility and transport landscape looking like you think it should, yeah, what would that be? Paint that picture.
It would look more like European cities that we know so well. We have a compact kind of like city situation where mobility is in various forms, and we have connectivity across the urban area. Rather than build freeways, roads, which we know the research is incontrovertible on this, you build more road infrastructure, you're going to fill it up and it will get congested. As our cities spread out as well, it just worsens that issue of urban sprawl, forces low-income people that can only afford to buy houses on the urban fringe where land is relatively cheap. And they're forced into a situation where they need one or maybe two cars to actually get to the places they need to be. We need to have a compact city form which is driven by a whole range of different transport modes so that people have quick, convenient and meaningful public transport readily available to them, and connections to those public transport hubs that are convenient and easy to do to encourage more healthier active travel kind of modes rather than just jumping in the car and all of the problems that that creates in our cities.
So how do things like the sharing economy fit into this picture, Doctor? And of course the rise of autonomous transportation.
Well, autonomous transport, as I said, I don't think that's a panacea or at all. It just means people are going to be more dependent on cars rather than consider other transport modes. And we've got a serious health problem as well. I mean, to say transport is one of these areas and mobility is one of these areas that brings together a whole range of different aspects of urban living. Right from, for instance, if you think the implication of our current transport systems on the erosion of habitat, if you think of the implication of our current transport systems on the erosion of food growing land, which we're going to need certainly as our population grows. This has all been eroded steadily, steadily. Our most productive food growing land in Australian cities is currently under bitumen and housing. And we've got to stop that happening for the very fact that if we can't grow food, we're in serious trouble. Not to mention our appalling rate of mammal and fauna extinction in this country is a direct result of habitat destruction, primarily because of major road infrastructure projects. We need to stop that trend, and we need to actually develop more integrated systems that enable people, for instance, to walk, bike, or take their wheelchair or stroller to a public transport hub and then use that as their way of getting around the city. But we're not serious at the moment in Australia about actually properly promoting public transport. I've worked recently on the suburban rail loop in Melbourne, and that's one of the key projects, I think, that could set an incredible example about how we can better transport plan our cities.
The science overwhelmingly tells us the urgency to act on climate change has never been greater. But why is it so polarising? Why are so many of us concerned and feel compelled to act, while others have little motivation for change or even deny global warming exists? What is the psychology behind this? To try and shed some light, I'm joined by Ben Newell, a professor of behavioural science. Ben, welcome. Let's start there. Why do some of us act and some of us not?
Well, it's a terrific question and one that has a very long answer, or perhaps a slightly shorter one. I think that, you know, the way that people process information and the bits of information that people find relevant in a given situation or a given circumstance differs across individuals. And so for some of us, we might have a more, I guess, egalitarian, communitarian type of perspective on how the world works. We might think more of others. We might be thinking about sharing our beliefs across different communities. And some research suggests that where you sit in on those kinds of measures, so what your kind of belief system is like, will affect the extent to which you're on board, if you like, with climate action versus not. But I think that what I've found interesting in the last few years working on this area is that there has been a shift away, I think, from the idea that people are just denying climate change out and out and saying, this isn't something that I need to worry about. Over the last 10 or 15 years, I think partly through, you know, the demonstrable effects of it that we're now seeing every time we look outside the window, it's become increasingly difficult to deny. And even though the deniers are quite vocal, they are quite small in number and reducing in their influence and reducing in their impact. But deep down at that sort of psychological level, I think it's, you know, our willingness to behave, our ways of getting engaged in different sorts of actions is influenced by lots of different things. So the beliefs that people around us have, the social norms that we adopt, also just by our general understanding. So climate change is something which is inherently uncertain. The outcomes are uncertain, the impacts are uncertain, and that kind of uncertainty can sometimes lead us to sort of avoid taking action. We think that the uncertainty is a way that we can excuse ourselves, if you like. So, well, we don't really know what's going to happen, so maybe we don't need to do anything.
Can people change? What needs to happen to make someone shift their position?
I think people can change, and I think getting the right kind of signals from, if you think about not just the information I can get as an individual, but seeing how society is changing, seeing how the information might be coming from governments or influential actors, then I think that can change individual cognitions. It's a slow process, and we know that things like, you know, political affiliations are very hardwired and have a strong influence on people's behaviors and the way in which they process information and information influences them. But getting those signals, getting that sense that, yes, this is something that is something that all of us need to be involved with and that we can make a difference. So some of the research that we did looked at people's perceptions of the efficacy of their actions. So how can what I do actually change the situation? And whether that's through changing my behaviors in terms of my transport or my food or my clothing, or whether it's simply being active and voting and getting out and talking to others, those things can have a sense of increasing your own self-efficacy. So the idea that I can actually do something to make a difference, and that can help us.
If unexpected uncertainty is a powerful motivator for change, would a major climate event cause action?
Well, I think you could say that it already is, right? I mean, there are things like the Black Summer, the bushfires here in Australia that were a major event that people could not really walk away from saying, well, there is a contribution of climate change here. And rightly, climate scientists have been very careful in making direct attributions of different events directly to climate change. But they can say that, you know, the likelihood of these events occurring without a climate change signal, if you like, being in the analysis, are increasing with the continuing rise in CO2 emissions. And so I think that those kinds of events will certainly already shifting opinion. And we can see it certainly in Australia in opinion polls where time and again climate change is becoming an issue that lots of people are saying, yes, we need to do something about this. The question is, you know, what do we need to do? And that goes back to that kind of efficacy question of how can I as an individual make change? But I think that, yeah, increasingly those kinds of events are putting the issue front and centre, and we can't get it out of our minds anymore.
So that passionate division that we have seen previously on climate change, is that changing?
I think it is. I think it has moved from a division that's driven by, this isn't an issue that we need to worry about, to one that is more driven by discussion about the right kind of solutions. Companies, you know, irrespective of government policy at this stage, are realizing that they have to change. The ways in which regulatory frameworks are now developed means that companies have to be able to report on these issues and discuss climate risk, you know, more generally as part of their operating. And I think that combined with investor behavior and people realizing that that's where the money needs to be going is creating the kinds of shifts that we need. Whether it's going to be in time or not is still up for grabs. And of course, you know, as I said, the uncertainty is a kind of debilitating factor sometimes.
India's government wants the country to be self-sufficient in an effort to ensure food security for its 1.3 billion people. The state of Madhya Pradesh is one of India's leading agriculture states. It's a population of 73 million, and it's initiating a shift towards an environment economic inclusive strategy for its farmers. Our India correspondent, Sara Aslam, joins us now. Sara, what exactly is Madhya Pradesh doing for its agriculture industry?
So, hi, Aurel. As you mentioned, that Madhya Pradesh is a leading agricultural state in India, and it has a huge population of 73 million people. So this year, in May, the Department of Farmer Welfare and Agriculture Development signed an MOU with the World Economic Forum. And under this agreement, the Food Innovation Hub India platform is going to be supported by the government, and it is going to facilitate innovations and emerging technologies in food and agriculture in the state. The aim here is to transform food systems by strengthening local innovation ecosystems to sustainably accelerate innovations.
So when you talk about government support, does that mean the government is paying?
There are global players from both the private and public sector who are driving and supporting this initiative. The hubs are being developed in other countries as well, including Colombia, India, as we mentioned, Europe, Vietnam, and Kenya. And these are supported by a global coordinating secretariat, which is funded by the Dutch government.
Sara, what type of technology and new technology and innovation is being used?
So, Aurel, it is, you know, for people who are watching the agriculture space, they are also looking at technologies such as remote sensing and geographic information systems to play a crucial role in agriculture in the coming decade. And this is going to range from identification of crops to looking at changes in the cropping patterns. And all this becomes very helpful for farmers, especially because this initiative is being branded as a farmer-centric initiative.
Indonesia is building what is being touted as the world's largest green industrial park in North Kalimantan. The $12 billion project is a collaboration between investors in Indonesia, China and the UAE and spans 16,000 hectares with plans to double that. The construction phase alone could attract 200,000 workers. We're joined now by our Indonesia correspondent, Randy Mulyanto, to tell us more. Randy, good to see you again. Now, what sorts of products will the park aim to produce?
Thank you for having me. So Indonesia's coordinating minister for maritime affairs and investment said he expected the country to produce a few million of electric cars by 2028. Well, 3 million cars, electric cars to be exact. But there will be some others that will be produced as well. Indonesia's President Joko Widodo has touted it as what you've elaborated earlier, that it will be the largest of its kind. So we should expect more things will be produced out of that zone.
So where does the project stand today? How advanced is it?
So according to the local media outlet, Radar Atarakan in North Kalimantan province, the media outlet quoted the leader of the Bulungan Regency, that's where the site will be located. The leader expected the construction will start next year in 2023, although the month and the date were not stated in the article. But he also elaborated, he also added that the land clearing itself will still be ongoing until the end of 2022, until the end of this year, as some parts of the land are still in the negotiation phase.
Mm. So, Randy, where will the massive energy requirements come from to power the park?
While the president, Indonesia's president, Joko Widodo, said the benefits will be seen in 5 to 10 years' time, you know, citing it as a leapfrog, we should remember as well that this will be very, very an ambitious project indeed. So Indonesia's business outlet, business.com, reported that the zone itself will build the infrastructure for solar panel and hydropower for 10 gigawatts each. So we should expect that there will be a massive capacity that's going to be built there. But we have to remember as well that this part of the country is located on the Borneo Island, on the Indonesian Borneo. So we should expect as well that this industrial zone will support the new capital in East Kalimantan province, which is also on the Borneo Island.
And now you just talked a bit about sustainability when it comes to renewables. Now, we know Indonesia is aiming to become a very competitive green product manufacturer and exporter, of course, and has pledged to become a net zero carbon nation by 2060. Is this realistic?
I read the other day an energy expert saying that the acceleration of electric vehicles in Indonesia would be one of the keys for the country to achieve that by 2060. But I think as of now, it's not yet a popular choice of transportation in the country, even in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta. And we have to remember that Indonesia has 37 provinces, some of them located in the east, some of them are less developed than Jakarta. So I think if the government does not focus on building the infrastructure, I think that target will not be attained by 2060. But still, Indonesia has less than four decades away to achieve that target. So hopefully that is possible. But I read this interesting finding by the International Energy Agency. It said key policy reforms and international support would be crucial to ensure the success of Indonesia's clean energy transition. So as long as the government focuses on that, I think it will have a higher probability that it will be achieved by then.
Thank you for joining us on APAC Weekly. To stay across the important conversations shaping our future, visit us at apacnetwork.com.